Boston.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This afternoon, the House voted by a resounding margin to give President Bush authority to use military force in Iraq. Senate approval is imminent, and West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd is outraged. Congress is abandoning its responsibility, he says, and giving the executive branch free rein to wage war on its timetable according to its agenda. In this hour, a grand old man, the U.S. Constitution, and the future of war powers. We begin with Pentagon preparations for war in Iraq. President Bush says that the Iraq war resolution should not suggest that military action is inevitable or imminent. Earlier today, I spoke with Bradley Graham, military affairs reporter with the Washington Post. I asked him if the pace and dimensions of the U.S. military buildup around Iraq square with the president's statement.
The buildup seems to be going very gradually and quietly. And indeed, it does not look like the U.S. forces are anywhere near being ready yet to launch a major attack on Iraq. What the United States has been doing in recent months has been moving a lot of equipment into place in the region so that when and if the signal is given for troops to move, they will be able to get into place much quicker and will not require the 5 or 6 months of buildup that preceded the 1991 war against Iraq.
So is there a kind of unspoken calendar that the buildup suggests, if indeed war is the outcome? Last time it was early in the new year. Does it look as though preparations are underway to meet that calendar if that's where things go?
What we're told is that it would be unlikely for any action to begin before the first of the year. When, of course, depends on what happens in the way of any kind of new inspection regime that might be set up. But the Pentagon does seem to be working on some kind of timetable that would allow for an attack as early as January.
And on the other end, how long could U.S. forces wait to attack, given the seasonal considerations, the heat of summer and so on? If the administration was determined to go in, how long could they wait for inspections and diplomacy?
Well, clearly the preference would be to do something in the cooler months in the region, which would be January, February, March, April. How long they could wait beyond that is largely anybody's guess. It certainly would strain a number of military resources to move tens of thousands of troops and aircraft and ships into place and then hold them there, particularly when there is a global war on terrorism that the United States is also fighting. But I haven't heard anybody put a hard and fast time limit on how long U.S. forces could then build up and stay in place.
In logistical terms and troop movement terms, Bradley Graham, what's the point at which the U.S. military is pulling the big trigger? What constitutes a kind of, all right, here we go? Is it feet on the ground? Is it actual troops? Or is it a certain amount of equipment? Is it when they unleash the huge transport planes full of X, Y, and Z? What constitutes the big thing? Or is it all gradual?
I think the critical threshold is the mobilization of troops, because that will involve not just active duty forces. It will very likely involve the call-up of tens of thousands of more reservists around the country, and this will then bring the war home to a lot of communities from coast to coast. There are already 70,000 reserves who've been called up just to fight the war on terrorism, and very likely many more than that will be needed if the United States goes against Iraq.
So to go into action in January, if that scenario played out, when would the mobilization have to occur?
We hear that the tether is anywhere from 45 to 60 days, which would mean that we would be likely to see mobilization orders come within the coming month.
There's a sense that the Bush administration may be trying to intimidate Iraq into getting into line, but not in such a way that it actually has to go to war. Is there a point at which, in terms of action, the war is almost inevitable? For example, if the troops are mobilized, might they still be called back, or is that really when the decision's been made?
All the moves up to this point are certainly reversible, and there could still be some additional moves like the movement of headquarters units and so on to the region that also could be easily reversed. Once you have large numbers of of troops moving to the region, well, then the costs and the discombobulation of the operation begin to mount, and similarly, there would be significant costs and discombobulation in reversing it. But even then, war would not be inevitable. It doesn't become a fact, of course, until the attack gets ordered by the president.
How do you put the attacks in the last 24 hours on the Iraqi air base airport at Basra in southeastern Iraq into this context?
Well, these sorts of attacks have been going on to some extent for years now. The no-fly zones of the north and the south over Iraq were established in the early 1990s after the Gulf War. There's been a notable increase in the provocations from the Iraqis and the responses by U.S. and British aircraft in recent weeks, and a clear statement by the Pentagon that the kinds of targets that would be hit in retaliation would be a larger group of targets than the U.S. warplanes had been hitting.
You don't see it as a significant step up in those sorties?
The step up has occurred in recent weeks. Today did not cross any new threshold.
So all in all, Bradley Graham, you see the U.S. military posture as generally in line with the rhetoric coming from the president. War is neither imminent nor inevitable.
Certainly the buildup's been consistent with what the president's been saying up to now.
On the other hand, it could deliver the action early next year if necessary.
That seems to be the timeline that they're on, yes.
Bradley Graham, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Bradley Graham is military affairs reporter for The Washington Post. He spoke with me earlier today from Washington.
Were I not to believe in the inherent ability of the Constitution to withstand the folly of such actions as the Senate is about to take, I would not stop fighting. 85. I'll be 85 years old. But don't you think for a moment I can't stand on this floor all the rest of this night. I like to fight when I'm fighting for the Constitution and for this institution. I'll fight until I drop. Yeah, I'll fight until they hack my flesh to the bone. And I would fight with every fiber in my body, every ounce of my energy, with every parliamentary tool at my disposal. And there are parliamentary tools at my disposal. Don't you ever think there aren't?
That was 84-year-old West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd on the Senate floor earlier this evening. The silver-haired senator has been raging about President Bush's congressional resolution authorizing military action in Iraq. The House voted in support of that resolution earlier today, 296 to 133. The Senate is set to do the same. But Senator Byrd is still fighting against what he says is a betrayal of the U.S. Constitution. Is the U.S. Constitution out of date when it comes to 21st century warfare? Or do you agree with Senator Robert Byrd when he says that Congress is abandoning its constitutional responsibilities? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us tonight from Stanford, California is Jack Rakove. He's professor of history at Stanford Law School and author of Original Meanings, Politics, and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. Good evening and welcome, Professor Jack Rakove.
Good evening.
Thanks so much for being with us. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire is On Point News analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello, Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Two Jacks and a big subject. Jack Rakove, take us into this. We have heard for days now Senator Robert Byrd raging, almost raving on the Senate floor at moments. And it's not just about whether or not we should go to war in with Iraq. There's a constitutional piece here that's not absolutely clear, I believe, to many listeners. It's not absolutely clear to me. What is Robert Byrd on about? What has him so hot under the collar?
You know, I'm not 100% sure I want to be in a position of speaking for Robert Byrd as opposed to, let's say, speaking for James Madison about whom I feel more
confident.
Well,
that's fair enough. If you look at the resolution that's being signed off on this very day, does it give you pause? Do you find yourself, from your understanding of the intentions of the framers of the Constitution, saying, wait a minute, perhaps as Robert Byrd is saying, perhaps not, but wait a minute, something's being violated here. Some power's being given away.
I think the best way to think about what Senator Byrd seems to be up to is to think about the resolution that's in process of being endorsed as a latter day equivalent of the Tonkin Gulf resolution. On the one hand, Senator Byrd should be happy, and I think all of us should be happy in general, that the administration very quickly seems to have abandoned the position that it was starting to stake out in the middle of the summer when its opening set of moves on the question of intervening or going to war against Iraq seemed to amount to saying there was no need for any congressional consultation, whatever.
We're just off to war.
That essentially that the president's power as commander-in-chief under dire circumstances when he judges that the essential interests and the security of the nation are at stake really enable him to initiate hostilities, acting in effect with his own discretion or exercising what's called his prerogative. The administration moved away from that, I think, fairly quickly. Although there were some very bold noises in midsummer, including an interesting article in the Washington Post based on a memorandum prepared by the White House Counsel Gonzalez. But the administration, as soon as that was announced, seems to have moved away from it, and seems, if not to have welcomed, at least not to have opposed the idea that Congress indeed has a bona fide role to play in a decision of this nature.
What is at stake here, Jack Rakoff? Then take us to the intentions of the framers, the War Powers Division,
right,
and what's on the line.
Well, I think what's at stake is a combination of understanding the basic outline of the Constitution and then thinking about the recent practice of the United States, going back especially to the debate over Vietnam and the Tonkin Gulf Resolution of 1964 and then the War Powers Act of 1973. The Constitution, whether you approach this as a matter of text, simply looking within what lawyers call the four corners of the document, or as a matter of reconstructing what we call the original intentions, the original understandings of the people who adopted it, seems to come down fairly strongly on the side that the basic decisions about who goes to war and the kind of defense posture that the nation as a whole should adopt are matters for congressional determination and not for unilateral presidential action. If, for example, you compare Article 1, which is the legislative article of the Constitution, with Article 2, the executive article, the strongest war power in Article 2, of course, is the clause which makes the president the commander-in-chief of the armed forces. Every other point of any significance which relates to the military posture of the nation, including, of course, the power to declare war, is vested in Congress by Article 1. So you simply start with the text. And this goes, by the way, to the trivial power of what's known as letters of marque and reprisal, which in the 18th century context is the closest thing we have to what we might now call today low-intensity conflict. Basically, it's what authorizes privateering.
We'll come back and talk about low-intensity conflict, but what's on the table here is potentially very high-intensity conflict. Jack Rakoff, stand by for just a moment. I want to bring Jack Beatty in. Jack Beatty, what do you hear in the lamentations of Senator Robert Byrd?
Well, one of the things I've connected with is he said last week, he quoted Madison saying that one man should not be tempted with so much power, the power to declare war through this grant of authority from the Congress at any time of the president's wish without having to come back to Congress. And he seemed to be saying that political temptation was part of that. And I don't know whether that was Madison's thought or not, but, you know, you hear things. There are three congressmen this week were talking to a friend of mine, and they're fearful of what they call the double bounce theory of temptation, that we're going to have a lot of flurry now and that it'll force social issues off the table. And we'll have an election. The Security Council will back inspectors. We'll back them. They'll go in. Inevitably, there'll be trouble. And then using this resolution and coincident with his reelection campaign, the president can attack Iraq. And I think that's the kind of thing that Madison was afraid of, that if you give him this kind of grant, it's too much temptation for what power corrupts. And
But the White House seems to be saying, we've got to have it. Circumstances have changed. It's a new world. At least Robert Byrd sees their view that way.
Well, I guess that just depends on how you see the. I mean, if you had an army, you know, if we could see an army at our border, obviously he has no time to go to Congress. But this, I just don't see that there is that kind of imminence here or gravity of threat. And with the CIA release yesterday of a statement saying that they didn't think there was any likelihood of an attack from Iraq unless we attack them.
We're talking tonight about war powers and the Iraq resolution. Senator Robert Byrd is all on and upset about it. Is the U.S. Constitution simply outdated when it comes to 21st century warfare? Or is it more important now than ever? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I believe that the American people have a better understanding of what the Senate is about to do, a greater respect for the inherent powers of the Constitution, and a greater comprehension of the far-reaching consequences of this resolution, a greater comprehension than do most of their leaders.
Senator Robert Byrd, West Virginia Democrat, on the floor of the Senate, railing against the resolution that has today passed the House of Representatives that will soon pass, by all accounts, the U.S. Senate, authorizing military action against Iraq. The senator says something vital is being threatened here in the Constitution and the division of powers between the executive and the legislative around war powers. The question for you listeners, does high-tech, high-speed terror mean the executive branch must be freed from congressional nitpicking when it's time to fight? Does the resolution passed today in the House honor Congress's constitutional role, or does it diminish it? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined tonight from Stanford, California, by Jack Rakoff. He's professor of history at Stanford University and author of James Madison and the Creation of the American Republic. Jack Rakoff, take us back in here. Once more, do you see a knife edge here up against the correct division of powers, according to the Constitution, evident in this resolution?
It depends which I think it depends in part which set of circumstances or what kinds of contingencies do we think we're responding to. I mean, to pick up on your last remark, if in fact we're talking about an electronic age where terror can be spread instantaneously, where the nation lies under all kinds of threats of sudden attack, then both the Constitution and the framers, and I think as well as our own common sense, tells us that there has to be some reservoir of power lodged in the government which is capable of acting expeditiously with as much promptitude as possible under any of those kinds of circumstances. And to use the language from the Constitutional Convention itself, as recorded by James Madison, of course there's a power to repel sudden attacks that inheres in the presidency.
Are you saying we don't need any constitutional amendment to do that, or has something changed in the world that we need to step up,
in a certain sense, I'm not sure the technology really makes any difference here. I mean, if the fears of sudden attack, which is expedited by the terrible technological efficiency of modern weapons as well as the surprise factor of terror, then in fact, no one's going to quarrel with the capacity of the president to mobilize all the resources of the nation to protect American lives and the national security. And that is, in fact, within the very different mental universe of the 18th century, that is a kind of scenario that the framers anticipated. The idea that the nation could be attacked suddenly when Congress itself was not in session, it would not make any sense to say that we don't defend ourselves until we can assemble Congress and vote a declaration of war. Now, what sets the Iraq thing apart, and what I've tried to write about a little, and I'm sure Jack Beatty certainly thought about this as well, we all have, is that the kind of operation we're discussing against Iraq cannot be neatly brought into the kind of 9/11 nightmare scenario. That's to say, the kind of war we're talking about really, in many ways, is war as it would have been recognized in the 18th or 19th or much of throughout the 20th century. Mm-hmm. It's a war that requires massive advanced preparation because we have to position all our forces and make the requisite diplomatic moves, whether they amount to anything or not. It's also a war which, in a certain sense, looks to be on a scale comparable to other massive engagements of forces. And finally, it really is war as an extension of national policy. And in fact, it's a war that would be fought ostensibly not just to neutralize the immediate dangers from the Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, but really to change the whole regime. This is war the way Clausewitz thought about it in the 19th century and the way people could have thought about it in the 17th and 18th century. And under those circumstances, it makes perfect sense to say that the constitutional rules, 18th century or not, still apply.
So James Madison and his cohort would have recognized this war, but does it still...
They could have understood it.
They would have understood it, but might it still not change the dynamic? President Bush says, look, it's not just a war that we have to go fight. It's that this regime is linked or potentially linked to terrorists who could deliver a lethal blow without ever, twitching an eyelid in Baghdad. And so it's not the same. Even though it appears the same on the surface, there's something new here. Is the Constitution capable of grappling with that?
Well, that's certainly arguably a legitimate justification for going to war. I'm not sure I understand how it really changes the underlying constitutional dynamics. Now, you know, we might well say, and I'd be prepared to argue this, that 30 years after the War Powers Resolution, whose authority presidents have never really conceded, there remains a great deal of uncertainty and a lot of, you know, fairly active political controversy over what the boundaries of congressional executive power ought to be.
So the War Powers Resolution that came in after Vietnam, Congress saying, hey, wait a minute, don't do that again.
Well, no, it says 69, you know, presidents can commit forces for a period from 60 to 90 days, but if they don't have congressional approval, then they have to be withdrawn. It may well be the case that if we're facing an open-ended situation in a post-9/11 world, that we'd want to rethink the basic constitutional understanding. But, of course, as everybody knows, amending the Constitution is virtually impossible, especially when it deals with substantive issues of, you know, of the respective powers of the different branches.
But if it's a changed world, maybe. Jack Beatty, still, when we look at this senator, and he's been in the Senate for a long time, he's second in seniority only to the nearly 100-year-old Strom Thurmond, and he's shouting, this is a blank check. Congress is ceding lock, stock, and barrel its power to declare war. Congress might as well shut the door and put up a sign that says, gone fishing. Is Robert Byrd just having fun here?
I think he's living out, he's sort of expiating his vote for the Tonkin Gulf Resolution. The Tonkin Gulf Resolution, the first sentence reads, Congress approves and supports the determination of the President as Commander-in-Chief to take all necessary measures to repel any armed attack against the forces of the United States and to prevent further aggression. Wayne Morse, one of the two senators who voted against that, called that a predated declaration of war. And that's just how the Johnson administration took it. And I think Senator Byrd is saying that any time the administration sees something that they can connect with Iraq, and the people are prepared to believe that anything is connected with Iraq, they have now the approval of the Congress to make war without coming back to the Congress under these new circumstances. And, you know, today the Congress turned down the Levin Amendment, which would really say we have to go to the UN. If the Security Council says no, then we have to come back to Congress for a declaration of war. They rejected that we can't have that. So it does look like a predated declaration of war, and that I'm not a constitutional scholar, but I find that hard to stack up against my notions of the Founding Fathers' distrust of concentrated power.
Listeners, is Senator Robert Byrd riding an antique hobby horse here? Is he out of date, or is he urgent? Is today's vote, in fact, a predated declaration of war? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Rakoff, Jack Beatty, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation now David Rivkin. He's a partner in the law offices of Baker and Hotstetler. He served in the Department of Justice and White House during the Reagan and George H.W. Bush administrations. Good evening and welcome, David Rivkin.
Nice to join you.
Thanks for being with us. David Rivkin, you have no doubt heard Robert Byrd, you could hardly miss him in the last few days, raging on the floor of the Senate that an important wall between legislative and executive powers being broken down here, that the war powers as envisioned in the Constitution are being despoiled by this resolution. How do you respond?
Well, I think he's making policy arguments masquerading as constitutional arguments, and as policy arguments go, they certainly have fallen on deaf ear with even his colleagues in the Democrat caucus. Let me explain, and I've actually written that I feel the president has inherent powers to deal with both a situation where we have an actual invasion or a situation where he's exercising anticipatory self-defense.
Do you mean he has powers even without this resolution passed
today?
Correct.
I've written the Wall Street Journal and other places about it, and if this was the case, we'd have a lively and spirited debate. But that's not the case. President, as a matter of fact, this is the position of his administration. Their view, as described in the papers some weeks ago, was that there is sufficient congressional authorization stemming from something called PO-102-1, which is the circa 1991 resolution, because it referenced, among other things, Security Council Resolution 678, that did not just speak in terms of liberating Kuwait, but talked about restoring peace and security to the area, which is still very much done. But my point here is very simply this. That's not what the administration chose to do. The administration chose to come to Congress and ask it for approval to use force. I know of no constitutional scholar who would sort of apply some form of non-delegation doctrine to the situation and say Congress can only approve the president's use of very careful doses of force 6 months at a time, come back to us for another approval in tightly controlled circumstances.
But what if this resolution is tantamount to a kind of predated declaration of war?
I would not quibble with this characterization, but my point is this. Congress has spent, congressional partisans have spent, not congressional partisans in the sense of partisans of an institution, not a particular party, have spent a great deal of time in modern history arguing that Congress is up to snuff constitutionally to being able to play a role as a co-equal player in the war powers area, that technology and the need to move a dispatch have not vitiated its role. To me, anytime some member of Congress says, not only have to come to ask for approval, but guess what? We're not going to give you a broadly focused approval. Mm-hmm. We're not going to give you approval that's contingent upon some exercise of discretion. And we're not going to give you an approval that lasts for a long time. We're going to give you approval that only goes for 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
That person basically produced the most devastating argument against any congressional involvement in this area, because it just doesn't work like this.
It's debilitating. David Rifkin, stand by. Jack Rakoff, I want to put that to you because I think it's a point of frequent confusion to the public, and David Rifkin poses this again, the notion that Congress is, in fact, under the Constitution, a kind of second-tier player when it comes to war. Is that correct in your view?
Well, I think some of David's points are well taken. And if you go back to this, approach it in the kind of historical context that I look at things, when the Constitutional Convention substitutes declare for make in the operative clause saying Congress shall have the power to declare war, the implicit and actually more than implicit understanding is that active congressional supervision of war would be constitutionally improper and politically unwise because that truly is an executive function. On the other hand, the qualification here might be, and I'd be curious to know how Mr. Rifkin would answer this. Historically, you would have said if Congress is really opposed to a war being waged by a highly militant or aggressive president, its basic solution would be to use what's called historically the power of the purse to cut off funding.
Right.
For the war, and it seems to me, if just to think about this as a matter of constitutional argumentation, if Congress were to exercise that power, say it's decided that President Bush has expanded the war aims far beyond anything it ever contemplated, and is leading us into a condition of perpetual war for perpetual peace or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
If Congress were to shut off the spigots, I'd be hard pressed to know where in the Constitution Mr. Rifkin would find the authority for the president to keep waging war against that kind of prohibition.
So you're saying effectively, Congress would have control at that level. David Rifkin, is that the appropriate place for Congress to hit the brakes or the gas?
I could not have put it better. Congress's primary tool to check the executive in this area is the power of a purse. In fact, just to make a brief historical footnote, it's a clumsy tool. There's a lot of it's a high political price you pay, but that's as you may recall what happened in the case of Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And Congress did it over a period of time. First, they used the power of a purse to block the expansion of a conflict, not particularly well, into Cambodia and Laos,
mm-hmm.
and eventually it was no money shall be spent. That is the proper way. Interestingly enough, people, again, who think that Congress should play a greater role indicate that that's not sufficient, and they're taking the view that Congress has to authorize any use of force outside of a situation. I think most people would concede that, if somebody crosses the U.S. border.
Mm.
But again, what's interesting to me and what's remarkable about Senator Byrd's remarks is that his remarks, again, essentially putting Congress in a sort of a commander-in-chief role, where instead of giving the general sort of a magisterial type of rule for use of force, he wants Congress in the driver's seat on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. And that is just so implausible and so devastating from a standpoint of having any efficiency on the military side or diplomatic side, that basically, if that's the view, and I think most people would understand that, then Congress is out of action. It just knocked itself out of the game.
You don't see that working. It can't play that kind of role. I want to invite our callers in. A lot of them want to join us. David's calling from Medfield, Massachusetts. Hi, David. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I absolutely don't agree that what Byrd wants to do is to put Congress in the role of commander-in-chief. But the thing that I did call about was it seems to me that the people who oppose this are opposing it on the basis of not wanting to give the president whether it's Bush or anybody else, a blank check with regard to, you know, expressing military power. And I'm just wondering, my real question is why aren't people demanding of Bush just come and ask us for a declaration of war? Why are they fiddling around with, you know, the resolutions that they they're doing? Why not just go back to what the Constitution says, and if Bush wants to, or any president wants to, go to war against somebody, mm-hmm. ask for a declaration of war?
It's a good, simple question, David. I want to put it to Jack Rakoff. Jack, what about it? I mean, we can imagine all kinds of answers to this, but what about the simple question? Why not a simple declaration of war here?
Well, this seems to me to be basically a distinction without a difference. I mean, it seems to be the key point to be established.
You're saying that's what we've got today.
It's, you know, I'm not sure what's the great distinction or the fine distinction between a joint congressional resolution of this kind and something we're going to label formally a declaration of war.
Well, I think there's a very important
December 8th, 1941.
But if you look at it politically, Jack Rakoff, you've seen lots of congressmen say, I'm not voting for war. I'm voting for all the steps that President Bush has agreed to take before we would go to war. War is not imminent or inevitable. It seems to make a big difference politically.
Right.
It seems to me the key matter is, actually come back to David's point, the key matter or the key point of dispute is what is the extent of unilateral presidential authority to commit the nation's armed forces under what kinds of circumstances. I think from my perspective as, I guess, a kind of constitutionalist, I think it's sufficient that the administration in the end backed away from the kind of the hardline positions of the midsummer, saying no further congressional consent was necessary and has asked Congress for this kind of approval. And also, I take issue. I haven't read David's pieces, but I'd be a little bit troubled by the idea that congressional resolutions adopted in 1991 under a different set of circumstances, with six or so intervening congressional elections and three presidential elections mm-hmm. since then, would constitute an adequate measure of consent. Given the change.
Let me just jump in.
Very briefly, David Rifkin. We've
very
got a
briefly.
Break coming up, but because this may come up again 10 years from tonight, when this resolution may be used.
Broad congressional language. Until replaced by new congressional legislation. Look, it governs. We have pieces of legislation that go back to the late 1700s and the early 1800s. They chose very broad language in 91, and I think they're choosing very broad language now, and it's going to endure until it's repealed.
David Rifkin, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's been great having you.
My pleasure.
David Rifkin is a partner in the law offices of Baker and Hostetler in Washington. He served in the Department of Justice and White House during the Reagan and first George Bush administrations. Listeners, we are talking tonight about war powers and the Iraq War Resolution. Senator Robert Byrd, Democrat West Virginia, has made hay and angry hay these last 3 days, saying the Constitution, the war powers, are being despoiled here. What do you think? Is the senator riding an antique hobby horse here? Is he out of date, out of touch, or is he onto something urgent? Is today's vote, in fact, a declaration of war? And a political question, are Democrats pretending they're not voting for war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about war powers and the resolution passed today in the House, coming up soon in the Senate. It will be passed in the Senate, authorizing military action against Iraq. Does the resolution passed today honor Congress's constitutional role, or, as Senator Robert Byrd repeatedly, angrily warns, does it diminish that role? Are you confused about what's been approved here? Is it good that you're confused? Does that mean Saddam Hussein is confused too? And who do you want to hold the power to take America to war? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. Our guest tonight from Stanford, California, is Jack Rakoff. He's professor of history at Stanford University. And joining us on the line now is John. Welcome, John. You're on the air.
Jack, I just want to make a point here. And my point is, I agree with Senator Byrd in the fact that there should have been a sunset of provision included in this resolution. The way it stands now, as far as my reading of it, is that we could go to war in 5, 7, 8, 10 years. This thing's been dragging out for 11 years already. And the second point I wanted to make is I think Congress had to take this vote to remain relevant in foreign policy and national security affairs. Without this, they would be relegated to, domestic affairs, Congress, rather than world affairs as well. And I agree with the vote. However, I think Byrd was entirely correct saying there should have been a sunset provision. I think that's what irritated him the most.
Good points both, John. Let me turn to Jack Beatty. Jack, John's kind of speaking to your thesis about how long this will stay an available resolution, how it could be used in lots of circumstances, this winter, next winter, the following winter.
Yeah, and he quoted last week Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln, as a congressman in 1846, protested President Polk's war against Mexico, and he especially protested the blank check that Congress seemed to give him about when to declare war. He said, he wrote to a friend, "Allow the president to invade a neighboring nation whenever he should deem it necessary to repel an invasion, and you will allow him to make war at pleasure, placing our president where kings have always stood." And I think that was what the caller and Senator Byrd are worried about, that kings have had that authority to when to make war, at what time, at their choosing. And Senator Byrd is saying, no, that is not what we do in a democratic republic, and that is not what the Constitution requires. When you need to make war, when all the resolutions have been sounded, when Iraq has been found in breach, when they don't cooperate, then you come to us, and we are not going to be hypocrites this time. And you're right, Tom. Many of these guys are being able to say, I didn't really vote for war. By God, if they're going to send American men and women to die, they should vote for war or not, and not with these subterfuges. I'm just voting for a process. They're giving him a predated declaration of war.
Well, that's what Robert Byrd calls it. Stan's calling from Lexington, Massachusetts. Stan, we recall a little Revolutionary War that began in your town. What's your view?
Yes, it's pretty clear that Byrd is correct on this point. And the suggestion that the Constitution is outmoded or might be outmoded really means that the Constitution would need to be amended. It can't simply be amended by executive fiat or by the executive pushing the envelope. I think Congress here has abandoned its obligations by not taking on the question of should there or shouldn't there be a war. The bar is set very high in the Constitution because it is so cumbersome to stop a war once it's begun. And I would take comments offline.
We've got it, Stan. Thank you for your call. Jack Rakoff, you hear what Stan's saying, and it's curious to me, or interesting, that both of our legal experts tonight, yourself and David Rifkin, are saying what's going on is generally within what the Constitution intends. We hear some pushback from listeners saying it feels fast and loose. Why this slipping of gears?
Well, let me qualify this and make sure we agree as to what I'm actually saying.
Okay.
To the previous caller, I thought my main point was I'm not sure that I see a great distinction between a formal declaration of war and a congressional resolution.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me the important thing is to prevent presidents from acting unilaterally, and whether congressional action takes the form of a resolution or a declaration of war is a secondary and, I think, a not very important point. But beyond that, then the question is, well, what is the content of the resolution or the declaration being adopted? And I certainly want to agree that while being skeptical that Congress can simply say put an arbitrary 3 months or 6 months or 9 months stipulation on this for reasons I tried to explain earlier,
mm-hmm.
because once war is initiated, you assume that its execution is inherently a presidential matter as commander in chief. I certainly agree with Jack Beatty and the callers, and vigorously disagree with David Rifkin that the idea of an open-ended resolution that has no terminus,
no sunset,
and that is so broad. That's quite dangerous, and I actually thought David Rifkin's last point before the break
mm-hmm.
almost gives the game away to say that in 1991 anybody was contemplating, three administrations later and six mm-hmm. congressional elections later, that the initial decision to go to war against Iraq, in behalf of Kuwait and in conjunction with UN resolutions would constitute adequate ex ante authorization
mm-hmm.
for a very different kind of operation with very different objectives on a very different scale,
mm-hmm.
and potentially with much much different consequences a decade and more later simply indicates what an absurd position, both constitutionally and politically, and I think even legally, that represents. Or it's the kind of narrow legalism that you might be convincing to an international lawyer, but should frighten the rest of us.
And though it's not, we should note, it's not held only by David Rifkin. This has been voiced by high-placed White House people. Tim's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Tim. You're on the air.
Hi. 2 points. One, my opinion, the Constitution says declare war. Declaration, resolution, maybe it's split in hairs, but they sure seem to be two different things. We've had the last formal declaration of war was in World War II. I guess I don't understand why the latter half of the 20th century seems to be so happy on the resolution versus the declaration. My second point, though, which is curious to me, is why the War Powers Act. To me, I have not heard much debate or public discourse on the War Powers Act and what that's about, and it seems as if both Congress and the President have been, in essence, nullifying the War Powers Act by simply ignoring it. We've had troops committed now in Afghanistan for over whatever the time limit of the War Powers Act, which I believe is 180 days for the President to do something, then check in with Congress on it, get congressional approval. Mm-hmm. The War Powers Act, to me, in my opinion, my viewpoint, has been completely ignored. No one's bringing it up. No one's even talking about it. What do your guests have to say on that one?
Tim, these are great points. Jack Rakoff, let me come to you, because both of these, in a way, relate to this sense that power politics are kind of overwhelming, straightforward speech here. First, why don't we declare war anymore? Would it be a nice cold shower or a way of bracing up to just go back to that simple language? And what about the War Powers Act? Is it simply being shoved under the bed?
Well, I think two answers here. One is that the formal declaration of war seems a bit cumbersome and overmuch when you can identify a whole host of kind of lesser interventions which seem to fall short of constituting war in the classic sense. And in fact, the State Department is always happy to compile briefs indicating, you know, that there are scores and literally hundreds of times when forces have been committed in low intensity ways.
But Vietnam, potentially Iraq, these are not small.
Well, okay, so Vietnam exposes the problem for which the War Powers Act, War Powers Resolution of 1973 is supposed to be the solution. But what the War Powers Resolution of 1973 primarily envisions is a president committing forces without having prior congressional approval and then not being able to keep them in action once a certain period has elapsed. That's distinct from, again, I think that's distinct from the current situation where we do have great advance warning or more than adequate advance warning and plenty of time to deliberate.
Is Afghanistan a transgression of the War Powers Act?
I was under the impression that Congress had authorized. Maybe Jack should correct me on this. That Congress had in fact approved that ex ante or concurrently.
I think we may have all lost track of how many days have gone by and what they're keeping track of.
And of course the question of whether or not they're an act of combat, whether war is actively being waged, they're simply being stationed overseas, pursuing other purposes in the way in which we have troops in lots of places. And sometimes under risk, as in the bombing of the Kohl or the Saudi Arabia, the Khobar bombings would be another distinction lawyers might want to argue.
Jack Beattie.
Well, but it's sort of the spirit of the War Powers Act, which, I mean, that was the fruit of bitter experience of what happened in Vietnam, where a resolution very like this one, open-ended,
right,
as an earlier caller said, was used, as Nicholas Katzenbach said, to the distress of the senators. It was tantamount, he said, to a declaration of war. Well, this is tantamount to a declaration of war, too, and the contingencies that are built into it. For example, according to this resolution, the president could make war if Iraq did not settle its claims with Kuwait. It could make war if it didn't clean up its human rights situation. It is not targeted to the weapons of mass destruction. So the president can make war not only when, but for different reasons, according to this document. And Senator Biden, in a hilarious piece of hypocrisy, said, "Oh, I'm not voting for that." Well, that's exactly what he's voting for.
Well, we will see what unfolds here. It was interesting at the top of the hour to hear that the troops are not necessarily pushing to imminent or inevitable war yet. So maybe this all is kind of a constitutional argument. Jack Rakoff, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome.
Jack Rakoff is professor of history at Stanford University and author of Original Meanings, Politics, and Ideas in the Making of the Constitution. And Jack Beatty, thank you for being with us this hour.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. In a moment, a Nobel moment for a Holocaust survivor. This is On Point. This year's Nobel Prize for Literature has gone to Imre Kertész, the Hungarian author who survived Auschwitz as a teenager. The committee said his work upholds the fragile experience of the individual against the barbaric arbitrariness of history. The 72-year-old Kertész, a Jew born in Budapest, was deported to Auschwitz in 1944, then to Buchenwald, where he was liberated in 1945. The Swedish Academy cited his 1975 debut novel, Fateless, about a young man who is arrested and taken to a concentration camp, but conforms and survives. In this passage, read by WBUR's Robin Lubbock, that young man remembers his first day in the death camp.
There's no new prisoner, I think, who's not a little bewildered at first by his situation. So, on arriving at the courtyard from the baths, we boys stared at one another for a long time, turning one another around and staring in wonder. Then a young-looking man, who was nearby, caught my attention. For a long time, and with great concentration, but at the same time hesitatingly, he kept touching his clothes, as if he was trying to convince himself of the true quality of the material. Then he looked up, like someone who suddenly has something to say, but on seeing nothing except the same clothing around him, decides to say nothing. At least, that was my impression at the moment. Of course, I was probably mistaken. I recognized him, in spite of his boldness and the convict suit that was too short for his height, because of his bony face. He was the man in love, who, about an hour before, the time between our arrival and our metamorphosis, had had such a difficult time letting go of the dark-haired girl. One thing I now greatly regretted. At home, I had once taken down a book from the shelf, a hidden book that had been collecting dust there for who knows how long. Its author was a prisoner. I didn't finish reading it because I couldn't follow his train of thought, and also because the characters had tremendously long and impossible to remember names, and finally because I wasn't the least bit interested in, and to be quite honest, was somewhat disgusted by, the lives of the prisoners. And so I was now unprepared in my time of need. From the whole book, I could only remember one thing. The author insisted that he remembered the first days of his captivity, that is, the furthest from the time of the composition, better than the later days that were closer to him. I thought then that such a statement was doubtful, somewhat exaggerated. Yet I now believe he must have been correct, for I myself can now remember my first day most precisely, indeed more exactly when I think of it, than all the other ones that followed.
That was WBUR's Robin Lubbock reading a passage from Fateless by Hungarian author Imre Kertész, the winner of this year's Nobel Prize for Literature. On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Amata, Kelly Jones, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Tim Skog, and Karen Schiffman, with help from Darren Manoogian, Oliver Reed, and Michael Garth. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.